Thanks very much, Mark, for that introduction, and thanks for the real privilege to actually be able to give this presentation this morning, and also acknowledging Betty Clapper for establishing this lectureship. The topic that I'm going to be talking about is one that's come up several times already in this conference, one that, amongst many others, is actually part of the really significant challenges we've got ahead of us over the next few decades, the 9 billion challenges we've heard it called. And climate change is a critical part of that. It's not always negative. Sometimes there's opportunities. In Australia, it's often going to be negative, but nevertheless, we actually have to look at the spectrum of opportunities, and that's what I'm going to be talking about here today. What makes success, some of our lessons about successes, risks and opportunities. And in giving this, I'm really both honoured and humbled to actually be able to talk about this to this audience. And also in doing it, I'm talking on behalf of many colleagues who have contributed to this work, so it's not just my work, but that of many, many colleagues over a long period of time. Now, just to give a little bit of context in relation to Australia and the US, so Australia is roughly the size of the conterminous US, about 10% less, I think, in terms of land area. And so we're actually dealing with a very similar sort of size and geographical entity. But latitudinally, Australia is actually quite differently located from the US. So as you can see, Australia is much more located towards the equator, whereas the US is located more towards the pole. So you have a lot more sort of cold environments, temperate environments. And just to give you a little feel for the location, the top left of the continent there, Melbourne, one of the key cities, the second biggest city, is roughly the same latitude as San Francisco or Richmond in Virginia. So we're actually significantly geographically located differently. So what I'm going to be focusing on today is the southern part of Australia, where most of the crop belt is, and looking at some statistics on that. But of course, it's not just as simple as that, because we actually have a different perspective on the world. But looking at our dollar at the moment is probably the other way around. So we have gone from a $1.05 US down to 72 cents at the moment. So our sort of ego is deflated considerably in that time frame. So just starting with a really simple proposition here, that the consequence of not matching your genetics, your management or your strategy in farming businesses is that you either incur additional risks that you don't need to incur, or you're going to underperform compared with what you could otherwise do. Fundamentally, this is actually what agriculture is all about. It's actually matching up what you do with the environment that you're actually dealing with. Climate change just focuses a little bit on that particular issue. So the logic, if you actually follow this proposition, the logic for adapting to climate changes is extraordinarily strong. To not do it is a really dumb thing. So, and it's not just about dealing with it in farm, it's actually about dealing it across the value chain and in the policy domain as well, and I'll cover some of that in my talk. So in Australia, we've got an extraordinary variable climate. We've got very poor natural resources. We look at the soils over here in the US, and we'd actually die for just a small portion of the soils that you have here. Your natural resource base is much, much richer than the one we have in Australia. But because of that, we've actually developed a whole series of mechanisms, policy, managerial mechanisms, to actually deal with those environments, those resources. And so we've actually got a fairly good farming system set up, which has actually increasingly moved towards the sort of yield frontier. So John Kierkegaard gave a good talk yesterday describing some of those ways we've actually done that. So it's an unsubsidised or largely unsubsidised agriculture sector, so we actually bear the risk of those decisions. So we've actually got very good risk managers in our agriculture. One of the issues, though, is that the probability distributions for climate, which is a fundamental part of that risk management, are actually changing. So we've sort of spent a couple of hundred years post-European settlement actually getting used to our variable climate, making lots of mistakes on the way, and all of a sudden the climate's actually changing underneath us. And so a lot of that risk management which we've had is useful in terms of dealing with climate change, but it's not exactly matching the needs for climate change. So, as I say, we actually have to now deal with changes in climate means, variability and extremes, which I'm going to focus on in this presentation. Now, just to give a couple of example slides of how things are changing, and this, of course, is happening elsewhere in the world, but this is a graph of temperature across southern Australia drawn directly from our Bureau of Meteorology website. So this is annual average temperature. You can see the black line, which is a 10-year running mean, goes upwards. There is no slowdown in the rate of warming across this environment. And importantly, if you actually look back to about 1960s, when I was born, the hot years then are actually about the same temperatures as the coldest years we're experiencing now. So at the current rate of change, very, very soon, we're actually going to be outside the envelope of past experience, historical experience. So we're actually going to be in new territory in terms of farming very, very soon. It's all, in fact, this year is going to be a record temperature again. The last 2 years were record temperatures. It's going to be a record temperature globally, according to NOAA and various other sources. And so that line is just going to keep on going up and up faster and faster, it would appear. So we've got to deal with that. Now, in terms of extremes, this is a graph showing the top decile, so the extreme hot years across southern Australia. So there's the area of the continent which is actually covered by those really hot conditions. So on average, you'd expect about 10% of the region to be covered by very hot conditions. And so that's the way it was for the most of the last century. But you can see, again, things are changing and changing very quickly. So the last 2 years were effectively 100% of southern Australia was in the hottest 10% of years, the hottest decile, so extremely hot conditions. This year, again, it probably will be 100%. So what we actually have now is that pretty much everywhere, every year, we'll have extremely hot conditions, and that's likely to increase in the future. Now, of course, that rainfall is a critical part of agriculture. We're essentially water limited in Australia for most of our agriculture. And this is just a quick snap of one of the implications in terms of water, of climate changes. So this is a graph of inflows to Perth Dam. So Perth is the big city in the west, southwest of Australia. And pre-1975, the inflows for these dams were about 330 gigalitres a year. I can't immediately translate that to acre feet or some sort of idea like that. But 330 gigalitres is the number there. The inflows this year to date, calendar year, have been 11.3 gigalitres. You can see from that trend, post-1975, it just keeps on going down and down and down. So we're actually getting to the point where not only we will have really, really restricted water availability for all users in that region, but we've actually got massive infrastructure which is actually being unused. So investments which actually aren't being capitalised on. So, and the really important thing here is that this is happening much faster than any of the global climate models would have predicted. So this is like a 2070 scenario for changes in water availability, but it's happening in 2015. So things are happening, they're happening fast, they're happening generally as we would project from the global climate models, from climate change projections, but they're actually happening faster. So there's a real issue here about underestimating the risk associated with climate change. Now, a few lessons that we've learnt. In terms of the sort of engagement with our political leaders, which is actually really crucial. So various studies here in the US and elsewhere have shown that leadership on climate change is actually the key factor, the key variable in terms of public opinion. And so what we actually have in Australia is we've actually failed to convince the Conservative Party leadership of climate change. We've failed to convince them of the science and the value of the science associated with that. And as a result, in Australia, just like in the US, we have views on climate change split across party lines. So we have, in effect, the Republicans saying it's not happening and the Democrats saying it's happening. And so it's a very clear split in Australia, just like it is in the US. And because up to recently we have had mostly conservative governments in Australia, they've actually dismantled virtually all of the policies and programs and research that was associated with climate change. And so we've actually gone significantly backwards in terms of our ability to deal with this issue, even though the issue itself is accelerating. So we've actually got a bit of a problem there. And I guess the lesson there is that we actually have to speak out loud and clear to our political masters, and I saw Rock put some statistics up there for congressional visits, but we have to do that, and we have to do that stronger and harder, and we have to be very honest about our motivations for doing this. So our motivation shouldn't be about lobbying for influence or money. It should actually be about getting an informed debate and effective policies that deal with this changing situation. Now, in terms of the public and the media, I think we've probably been partially successful. So a recent survey showed that almost half of Australians say that climate change is happening and it's due to human influence. Around about a bit over a third say it's happening but due to natural forces. So together, that's about 84% of the public saying that climate change is happening. And you compare that with the political positioning, which is essentially in denial. So there's a very big disjunction happening between public views and the policy and political views. Only 8% of Australians say that they think climate change isn't happening. So it's a very small group, but with disproportionate influence, particularly in the media. And when you actually ask the rest of the populace how many people do they think say that climate change is not happening, it's about 23%. So they've been so effective in terms of pushing their agenda that they're actually, other people think they're overrepresented in terms of that belief, that view in the public. And those 8% themselves, when they're asked how many people share your view, they say that 50% of Australians say that climate change is not happening. So there's a whole stack of delusion and misperception that's happening here, largely because, I think, because the media fails to represent the science adequately and fails to represent the strength of the science, the 97 scientists versus the 3 deniers. And they try to pretend that this is a balanced view and a balanced debate, and in fact, by doing so, they actually misrepresent the reality and they misrepresent the options available to policy and to the public. We also see significant optimism bias when we actually look at these surveys. So that's essentially saying, yes, climate change is going to hurt other people, but it's going to be someone else. It's not going to impact me. We also see significant what we call psychological distancing. So yes, climate change is going to impact, but it's going to be far away geographically and far away in time, so we don't have to worry about it now, in spite of the fact that there's good evidence that it's in fact impacting right now. So there's some negatives there, but the positive here is that adaptation to climate change is actually supported by about 70% of the Australian population. They actually want more in terms of adaptation. They want more policies, they want more research, they want more expenditure, they want more action. And this is actually linked to salience, which is the concern about climate change, the personal relevance of climate change and the importance of climate change, or the perceptions of the importance. It's also linked to the ethics and moral views of individuals, and also linked to whether they see science and scientists as trusted in terms of this debate. And so when you tick all of those boxes, you actually end up people who are actually very strongly supportive of adaptation. And so the sort of message here is that when you actually start to talk to people about solutions, which is the topic of this conference, people start to actually engage and they start to support, even though they may not support some of the underlying propositions. Now, with the farming community, I think we could say we're ambiguously successful. So farmer-stated views are actually quite a lot more reticent about climate change, acknowledging it, than the average populace. So only about half of the farmers, the ratio is about half of farmers compared with the average populace say that climate change is happening and it's human-influenced. And there's about a 4 times over-representation in the denial camp, the ones that say that climate change isn't happening at all. So farmers are actually much more conservative in their views than the average population, even though they're at the front line of climate impacts. And so what we're actually starting to see is some interesting things, because about 75 to 96%, depending on surveys, 75 to 96% of farmers actually say that they're adapting to the changing climate that they're seeing. And it makes sense to do so for that basic proposition that I put up front. You know, if you don't adapt, you actually go backwards. And so what we're actually seeing then is cognitive dissonance. We're actually seeing the two sides of their brain actually arguing with each other and trying to actually figure out what to do. And that actually causes stress. We know that causes psychological stress. And when we actually do analyses and different studies, That stress related to climate is actually least for those people who both acknowledge the climate change and that's changing, and who are doing something about it. So they're actually empowering themselves, they're being proactive, and they're taking their future into their own hands, and they're the ones who are actually best positioned and least stressed in terms of climate change. So the message here is that we can actually, through effective communication of our science, the topic that Sonny Ramasamy talked about in the first day, if we communicate that science well, if the science is relevant, we can not only help people from a technical perspective, but we can actually help their well-being and their psychological well-being as well. So there's a lot of benefit from happening from doing our job and doing it well. It's not just about increasing yields. Now, of course, to do that, we've engaged with a lot of farmers across the nation, working with them in different ways, looking at how they can manage the existing changes in risk and how they can manage future changes in risk. And I don't expect you to read this, but it's just the results from one of those studies where we actually look at changing factors that influence cropping systems and look at the agronomic options available and the activities that may need to be put in place that aren't in place now. So a lot of the agronomic options are ones that are already in our toolkit but not necessarily being used at the moment. So they're available to be used for adaptation but not necessarily being used at the moment. And part of this also is bringing in new tools such as climate change ready crops, ones that are responsive to carbon dioxide. Lou Ziska has been talking about this for years now, and also responsive to increased heat conditions. So we're actually seeing really significant losses now from high temperature conditions already. So as a consequence, our breeding programs are focusing on that as well. But dealing with the agronomy and the on-farm components and sort of tactical responses is necessary but not sufficient in our view for effective adaptation. So when we actually start to go through with the same group of farmers, we go through multiple years of engaging with them on adaptation. In the first year they'll start out thinking about agronomy, you know, changing varieties, changing planting dates, that sort of thing. But in the end, after several years, what they're focusing on is strategic business management. So it's not about the tactical, it's about the strategic. And in fact, if this is transferable, it actually is a way of actually boosting people's adaptive capacity, just fast-forwarding straight to the strategic business management skills. So people can actually make much more strategic and proactive decisions. Then they can go backwards to look at what are the technical and agronomic and crop science options that can actually support those strategic decisions. So this is what we call the journey from sort of agronomic thinking to strategic business management. And I think it's really important to actually recognise that it's the strategic stuff which is the crux of the issue. Now, when we're actually talking to people about adaptation, there's a real tendency for people just to focus on what we call incremental adaptation, which is just changing the existing system, so marginal change to existing systems. We actually think it's really important to break out that discussion into other options, what we call systemic or transformational adaptations. Because if we actually just focus on the existing systems, we actually may be missing out on opportunities, and we may be locking ourselves into adaptation paths or maladaptation paths, things that may not be beneficial in the future, so that limit our options to make responses in the future. So we actually think that as these changes will increase, we'll actually see increasing numbers of examples of transformational change and systemic change. And we've already got farmers and companies who are doing this in Australia. So it's not future gazing. This is already happening, and quite significant companies are making very, very substantial changes in their strategic investments and positioning. Now, again, messages from yesterday's talk by Kenneth Quinn and Sonny Ramasamy, communication is fundamental here. So if we're actually serious about having our science being adopted by different users, we actually have to think very hard, and as I know you do, think very hard about the nature of the relationship between that science and the users. And so the old sort of top-down approach just doesn't cut it when you're actually dealing with uncertain issues such as climate change. Oftentimes, the knowledge base of those stakeholders is far greater than the knowledge base of the scientists who are actually engaging with them. And we have to actually acknowledge that and respect that difference. And that actually means you're bringing those people in not as subsidiary entities, tools, as part of your research program, but you're actually starting to bring them in as partners, people who can actually make significant contributions in their own right. And there's all sorts of grades between different levels of engagement, and it's just a matter of choosing the right level and then being honest about it with people so everyone knows what they're actually getting in for when they actually start to engage in a research program. So saying to people, well, yes, it's going to be participatory and you're going to have some control over the research agenda when it doesn't happen is a great way of disenfranchising people. And you can't afford to disenfranchise people in politically sensitive issues such as climate change, because they'll leave and they won't come back. It'll just reinforce negative views that they may have. So, as I mentioned in this cartoon, I think it's really important to talk the language of our stakeholders. Even if you don't necessarily talk that yourself or don't have a philosophical or logical alignment with it, you know, the climate change threatens our existence versus climate change threatens our economy sort of thing, is that it doesn't really matter at the start. It's accepting their position and accepting the values and understanding the values and then actually having that dialogue. And eventually, my experience is that they will actually come to actually adopt very much the position that we bring, because the facts do speak for themselves and the opportunities that arise from taking early action are often very clear once people start to think about this strategically. We actually think that it's really important to focus on, or to defocus a little bit on the fixation on global climate models as the only source of information about climate risk. So at the moment, global climate models typically, people will grab some results, they'll plug it through a crop model and give a scenario for 2050. And in doing so, they completely alienate themselves from most stakeholders. It's just the wrong information for the wrong time scale, producing the wrong sort of output. What we actually think is we need to do is a different approach. As well as it just being sort of wrong in terms of spatial and temporal scale, it often has very low confidence of changes. So we see, for example, GCM, some will say it's going to get a lot wetter, some will say it's going to get a lot drier, and the average farmer will shake their head and think, oh, well, I'm not going to bother with this, and they'll go off and continue doing the things as they were before. There's also a really significant difference, and these studies have shown this, a significant difference between what farmers and agribusiness wants in terms of climate information and what climate scientists think they want. And the two are quite mismatched in terms of the nature of the information and the scale of the information. So there is a lot of work to be done to actually make these things match up a little bit better. So what we often do to engage people is we actually focus on existing trends in climate, ones which actually have well-known underlying drivers, so that's a good process knowledge, a good causal knowledge of what they're doing, and actually engage with them on that basis, because most farmers are very experiential. They're sensates in Myers-Briggs terms. So they'll actually believe stuff that's happened, but they won't believe stuff that's a black box projection, according to them, that they don't understand. And so you actually move from a position of understanding and acceptance into the unknown rather than the other way around. And so engagement can actually be done quite effectively through this in terms of the issue. And it's also at the right temporal scale. It's actually relevant information for the decisions that they're going to be making this year and next year and the year after, because that's the time scales most people make decisions. So what we're actually doing is we're developing approaches that don't overly rely on GCM. So GCMs are part of that spectrum of activity, but actually give alternatives to the usual use of GCM. So it's exploring low regrets and no regrets and robust options. So ones that, we understand the trade-offs and people are accepting of those trade-offs. So one of the key lessons here is you don't make climate projections and the uncertainty around those the focus of practice or policy discussion, because it actually leads you into a groundhog day where you just go round and round and round and round in a circle and you actually don't make progress. Now, we actually also have to think beyond the farm, and Ellen just mentioned activities with value chain partners, and that's a really crucial part of the picture. It's not just what happens on the farm, but it happens in pre-farm and post-farm, and changes that you actually make at any part of the value chain can impact on other parts of the value chain. So we're working with some of the biggest producers in Australia and value chain operators in Australia, looking at disruptions in their value chain and looking at better ways of managing risk across their value chain. We've got tools which we're developing which enable us to do that. And without going into great detail about this, we actually see this as a really important step, because the influence of some of these big operations is extensive in terms of what happens on farm and in terms of supporting adaptation actions by farmers. But as soon as you do this, you actually enter into that territory that Rod Snyder talked about the first lecture, which is actually you have to think about climate change integrated with all the other issues. So it's a very integrated approach that's needed to actually make these decisions. And it's not about running an impact assessment model which sort of tries to integrate these things, because most of these companies, most of these operators have really good mental models of their own, or other models. They may be spreadsheet models or something else. They have policies and they have guidelines. They've got a whole stack of information that influences how they respond. And it's a question of how we can actually mesh our science with the things that they have and the things that they use. So not assuming that our tools are the ones that are most appropriate for the decision. Now, it's really important to actually mention people. You know, Rock mentioned the importance of people just before. And if you actually don't focus on the people component, you actually miss out on some of the richness of the picture and the avenues to influence in climate change. So this is work done by Anne-Marie Dowd and others, which looked at social network analysis of two different groups. So one of them was essentially incremental adapters, so those people who are just wanting to do marginal change to existing systems, and the other were transformational adapters, so people who are making large-scale changes in terms of land use or location or activities. And what we find when we look at the social support networks, those for incremental adapters incredibly strong and very local. Those for transformational adapters were much weaker and often at a distance, so geographical distance. And so the standard literature says social networks are really important for adaptation to climate change and many other things. But in fact, it's not necessarily as simple as that. Is that, yes, social networks are really good if you actually want to continue largely to do what you've been doing. But if you actually want to change, the norms associated with those social networks, which are often quite strong in farming communities, actually a big limit to the change. So they actually limit what you may actually consider as viable adaptation opportunities. Now, if we actually look at the information networks, it's exactly the opposite. So the information networks for incremental adapters are weak, again, quite local. They're largely happy with the way that things are doing. They're not, you know, going out and searching for huge amounts of new information. Transformational adapters are absolute sponges for information, because they're making large-scale, complex, risky decisions, and they want as much information as they can to actually make those decisions work. And so when you're actually starting to think about this, if you actually have a policy which is a one-size-fits-all policy, you're actually not going to be able to match the needs of different types of adaptation. You're going to miss the mark. So understanding the social networks, understanding the people and how they respond is actually crucial in this issue, as in many other issues. And if we actually want to have good adaptations that enable people to make the best decision for themselves, we have to be inclusive of these different types of adaptation responses. Now, just the last sort of substantive sort of slide here, Mike. Just an issue about policy. So there's a lot of talk about policy engagement and science. Sometimes I see it done well, oftentimes I see it done quite poorly. Often when it's done poorly, it's because scientists actually enter into those discussions with policymakers with what we call a science gap model, which is just that more knowledge, it leads to action. So if only we could get them to understand, if only they read this paper, if only they had that database or that decision support model and they used it. And it actually doesn't work that way. So it just doesn't tick almost any of the boxes on policymakers. It doesn't recognise that they actually are professionals working in complex environments with their own sets of tools for actually managing the situation and managing the complexity. And the stuff that we bring to them is a small part of the total picture that they're looking at when they're actually making decisions. So if you actually want to engage with governments, what we're trying now is actually engaging with them on a much more sort of an economic policy agenda. So it's actually starting to think about what's the rationale for government investment in this topic, in this sort of agenda, in food security, in managing the 9 billion challenge? So inevitably that goes down the usual routes, like addressing market failures, but it also means we start to think about public values failures. So does the investment in science actually deliver what we say it does? The broad scale sort of view of science as beneficial to the public, strengthening our economy, etc. What's the evidence that that actually happens? So we often say these sorts of things, but in fact don't necessarily deliver, or don't have the metrics to demonstrate delivery. So we need to think about those things. We also need to think about policy and how it can reduce the barriers to adaptation, because there's lots of them, and often you don't know what they are until someone actually starts to try. So there is a learning by doing activity here, which is really quite interesting. So one example of this was in the millennium drought, really bad drought going back a few years, a rice grower down in the southeast, there was zero water allocation. Went from 100% water allocation almost every year, guaranteed water supply, massive rice crops, very good rice productivity, to zero. And so he was looking, well, where can I go where it's raining and there's plenty of water to actually grow some rice? And so he actually decided to go up to the northwest of the continent, so right across the continent, 5,000 kilometres sort of thing. And so he organised to take all his laser levelling equipment up there, etc. And the thing that he didn't bank on was that in doing so, he had to cross five state borders, and every state border had different road regulations in terms of police cars in front or police cars behind, or licences or size of the equipment that was allowed and times of driving and things like this. And it took him months to actually overcome the paperwork. And no one had actually tried to do this before with farm equipment. And so we only found out that there was a barrier there because someone tried it. And so that's one example of those barriers, which actually can be solved by policy harmonisation. So we actually need to be very sensitive to those policy barriers or barriers that can be influenced by policy and remove them. There's also institutional inertia. So in that rice growers example is that the Rice Growers Association and the funding bodies associated with that aren't going to fund that farmer to actually explore some other grain or go into livestock, because that's outside their boundaries. And so it's not in their interests as an institution, or if you've got a department, agriculture department, and someone wants to move into ecosystem services, it's not in their interest to actually enable or help and support that adaptation. So you actually have institutional boundaries which actually limit what can be done. So we need to think about those things quite broadly. Our sort of hypothesis is that if we actually do that sort of economic policy agenda and do good work on those barriers, that we can actually start to move away from defining the problem, which is where a lot of the science has been to date, to actually developing and implementing solutions in partnership with those people who actually have the responsibility to do those changes, farmers, people across the value chain. So just a quick summary is that in Australia, as in many parts of the world, is that climate changes are a clear and present danger, but they're also an opportunity. And oftentimes, the choice between whether it's a danger or an opportunity is yours. There is a choice as to how you see this and how you respond. And what we're actually seeing in Australia is people who are proactive and are first movers in terms of climate change are actually making very good money out of it. So there is a choice about how you respond to these issues. I think we actually need to raise our voices as a science community, and we need to have clear and strong and trusted voices in the public debate and in the policy sphere as well. We actually need to raise that profile, because whilst there is a group that says this is not an issue, it's not happening, it will be held back, and we will have suboptimal policy development, we will have suboptimal decisions being made on farm, which risk the farmers, which risk the financial system, and which risk the natural resource base more than it does necessarily has to. We need to connect our science with the decisions that are being made now, not hypothetical decisions being made in 2050, but the decisions that people are making right now, and who are looking to good information to make sensible investments. And I think we can help there, as long as we actually frame our science correctly. Partnering for solutions, the topic for this conference, is fundamental if we actually want our science to go into action. And I think most of us actually in this game, because we actually want our science to be used, we actually want those things that we've worked on to actually be used by the farming community and actually be benefiting people. And so we actually need to be thinking about what's the nature of those partnerships and building long partnerships, because as far as we can tell, this issue is going to be with us for decades or centuries. So we actually need to be thinking, likewise, partnerships for decades or centuries. The crop science that we all love is a critical but not sufficient part of effective adaptations. So we can't do good adaptations without the crop science, but by itself, it has to be meshed with other types of science to be maximally effective. So it's those partnerships within the science community which are actually going to add the greatest value as well. We need to think about adaptations being strategic. We need to think about them being comprehensive, you know, incremental through to transformational, and we need to integrate them with other issues that are of concern, whether it's to a policymaker, someone who's managing a value chain, or a farmer. As I mentioned, we have to think value chains as well as on farm, because so much of what's going to happen, I think, in the future will depend on those organisations which have such a strong influence on the value chain. Policy engagement, I think, will become increasingly important whilst we need to get over this hurdle of denial, whilst climate change is seen as an exception rather than part of the mainstream of decision making. Because whilst it's an exception, it's very easy to marginalise, it's very easy to actually disconnect and reduce the funding. We actually need to just have it as part of normal decision making, because it is just part of the world that's changing. We actually need to accept and recognise that and communicate that. And the last point is that never forget the people in the social networks, because they're often the pathway through which change occurs and which through trade-offs and disputes are mediated and negotiated so that people can actually make progress. So if we actually ignore those components, the social and cultural components, we can often make significant errors, or we can slow down the changes that are needed. But I think if we actually do all of those above, then we can prosper in the years to come, the changing years, the storm that might be coming across the fields. But the only way we can do that is if we adapt together. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. That was a wonderful presentation. Very nice overview of. Don't leave yet, Mark. it's very nice to get that perspective, and I hope you enjoyed that very much. Nice to also see how the link back to the communication that's so important for us, and advertising and moving our science forward. Well, on behalf of the members of the Crop Science Society of America, I would personally like to thank you for this wonderful presentation. And as a small token of our appreciation for being with us today, I would like to present this plaque to you, which states, "The Crop Science Society of America recognizes Mark Howden as a distinguished scholar presenting the 2015 Betty Klepper Endowed Lectureship funded through the Agronomic Science Foundation." Once again, a warm round of applause for Mark.